No, just to digress slightly, because as most of you know, the Winter's Tale is sometimes the question of the aunties, who invites comparison, of course, above all with Othello. It is sometimes said, and rather foolishly, I think, that the jealousy of Othello is much more convincing than that of Leontes, because Iago gives Othello extraordinarily powerful reasons for believing that his wife is unfaithful. But the point is that the two plays are very different. What has happened in The Winter's Tale, as Shakespeare knew perfectly well, is altogether possible and must have happened many, many times in the history of the human race. And by writing as he did, and if you read the scenes of which I've given just a synopsis, you'll see that it is exceedingly convincing, even though there's only about 20 lines between Leontes expressing his great love for Polixenes and his aside expressing his jealousy and suspicion. Nonetheless, it is exceedingly convincing the way Shakespeare writes it. And Othello, the weakness of Othello is not being a suspicious man. Clearly, that is the great weakness of Leontes. Othello is not suspicious. He says, that he's not easily suspicious, but I forget the exact word, but being wrought, that is, being acted upon, perplexed in the extreme. Othello's weakness, as he says, that he is one that loved not wisely, but too well, meaning that he loved too passionately, but without the wisdom of perceiving the value of his wife. If he had, and as is often said also, that if Hamlet and Othello could have changed places, there would have been no tragedy in either case, because Hamlet would have seen through Iago, and Othello would have had no difficulty in killing Claudius. Each play has its weakness, a particular weakness. The weakness of Othello is a certain blindness. The weakness of Hamlet is the inner lack of resolution. The weakness of Leontes is blindness also and suspicion. But he overcomes this. And he enters now into purgatory. But although The Winter's Tale is about the shortest, I haven't counted the lines when I say that, but I have looked at the pages in my copies of Shakespeare, and I do find that it is remarkably short compared with even with The Tempest, which is not a long play, or Cymbeline. But it covers a greater span of time than any other play of Shakespeare's, because of the device of time entering in after this scene, which we've just had as a chorus, and telling us that he will fly over 16 years. And time tells us that during this period, Leontes has shut himself up for grief. This interval of spiritual retreat between Acts 3 and 4 may thus be said to coincide exactly with Dante's Purgatorio. We are therefore now, to use Dantesque language again, at the top of the mountain of purgatory, where Dante places the earthly paradise. The play, that is the spiritual path, has reached the primordial state of human perfection, personified, as it were, by the 16-year-old Perdita, the daughter of Leontes and Hermione. Her name, that which was lost, given her by the oracle, indicates this, because that which was lost, precisely, amongst its other meanings, is primordial perfection. Her name, that which was lost, given her by the oracle, indicates this, together with the fact that she has been brought up among shepherds who are always associated with primordial innocence. And it is a remarkable feature of all Shakespeare's last plays, which are known as the romances because they are too profound to be called comedies. That is Cymbeline, The Winter's Tale, and The Tempest, and also Pericles may be counted as well. It is a characteristic that there's always one person or more who has been brought up right away from corrupt civilization. For example, in Cymbeline, the king's two sons, whom Bellarius takes away as babes, and he brings them up right away from human society in natural, altogether natural surroundings. And Miranda is brought up on the enchanted island by her father, again far away from the corruption of Milan and Naples. And Perdita is brought up by shepherds, by the shepherd who found her, and whose daughter she is supposed to be, because he doesn't say, it's not generally known that she was a foundling. Meantime, Florizel, the son of King Polixenes, a youth of the same age as the dead Prince of Sicilia, has discovered the beautiful shepherdess, for so he takes her to be, and they have fallen deeply in love. It is significant that the way they met is significant. One day when he was out hawking, his falcon flew over the shepherd's land, and the falcon is one of the birds of Apollo. Florizel is prepared to sacrifice everything for Perdita. Only she, not the shepherd, knows that he is the prince. To the shepherds who meet him, he pretends to be a farmer. But the king has noted his increasingly frequent absence from the court, and he has found means of tracing him to the shepherd's house. He consults Camillo, who is still at his court and has become his right-hand man, most trusted. Though Camillo, in a previous scene, is begging him now to allow him to return to Leontes and to Sicilia. He is very homesick for his own country. And the king and Camillo decide to go to the shepherd's house in disguise to see what Florizel is about. And it is the festival of the sheep shearing. And it is not without significance that this part of the play should be set in late summer, which is the season of life in which Leontes now is. At the same time, this season is to be for him overlaid with spring, in virtue of the primordial state which Perdita stands for. And this is emphasized here by her being dressed as Flora, the goddess of spring. I should point out perhaps that the king and Camillo are unrecognizably disguised. Perdita distributes flowers to the guests. She gives the king and Camillo flowers of late summer. And then comes to her most famous speech as she turns to the prince. But first of all, in this connection, there is rather, as I was speaking about initiation, there is rather a remarkable conversation between the king and Perdita, because she apologizes for the lack of gillyflowers, which is a kind of carnation, and she says that she doesn't put them in the garden because they are hybrids, the result of a kind of graft. You see, we were talking about graft. They're not produced naturally. They're a kind of hybrid. And Polixenes argues with her. He says, but why do you object to the practice of grafting a noble scion on a baser stock to enable it to produce nobler fruit? And it is rather ironic that, because the whole question of is precisely the problem of Prince Florizel, a noble scion, uniting with the baser stock of the shepherdess. But she disagrees with him, and this is again an aspect of her personification of primordial nature, because she represents the new shoot which is grafted. And therefore she will not, in her garden, she's not going to put any old stock at all. She's not going to have these mixed things. Her garden, she's going to keep entirely primordial. I think we must, although this is not perhaps too subtle on my part, but I don't think Shakespeare can have been unaware of what he is saying in that speech. However, this is a detail. I don't wish to set any stall by it or draw any particular confusions. There are quite enough facts to demonstrate that Perdita, she who is lost, represents what man lost at the fall. Then she turns, having given these flowers of summer, which are there, to the men of middle age, she turns to Florizel and makes her most famous speech, which begins, "I would I now, my fairest friend, I would I had some flowers of the spring that might become your time of day." And then she goes on to describe very beautifully, the speech you probably all know, the flowers she would give him, the spring flowers she would give him if she had them. Then, after some dancing and singing, the shepherd announces that he intends to give his daughter in marriage to Doricles, that is, Florizel. And finally, the king shows who he is, takes off his disguise, and forbids his son ever to visit that house again, on pain of death for the shepherd and for Perdita. The king goes out in anger. Florizel pleads with Camillo to help them. He tells them to go at once to King Leontes in Sicilia. Then he tells Polixenes of their escape, after having given them time enough to escape and to set sail. And he persuades Polixenes to follow them and to take him with him. For as I said, he longs to return to his native Sicilia. Before they set sail, however, the shepherd is persuaded by his son. They are both in fear of death, to go to the king and tell him that Perdita is not his daughter, and how he found her, and the name of Antigonus, to tell him also the name of Antigonus, who had left her as a babe wrapped in a rich mantle. And they see the king, and the king takes them, they're about to set sail, the king takes them with him to Sicilia. Then there follows what I would describe as one of the most moving scenes in Shakespeare. We are again with Leontes at his court. The priestly Cleomenes says to him, "Sir, you have done enough and have performed a saint-like sorrow. No fault could you make which you have not redeemed. Do as the heavens have done, forget your evil. With them, forgive yourself." They try to persuade him to take a second wife. But Paulina protests and reminds them that the oracle has said the king shall live without an heir if that which is lost be not found. Because they, the argument for making Leontes marry again is that he shall have an heir, that he shall have a son to take his place when he dies as king of Sicilia. But Leontes is, one has the impression he is completely changed. One is impressed by his extraordinary serenity. He's inclined to think that heaven will take care of this question, and he promises Paulina that he will never marry unless she gives him permission. And she says, that will she not, until he finds someone equal to Hermione. Then comes news that the Prince of Bohemia and his wife are in Sicilia, and they beg Leontes to give them an audience. And he sends word that they shall come. And then Florizel and Perdita enter into the courtroom, into the presence of Leontes. Now, the audience, of course, know that Perdita is Leontes' lost daughter. But he does not know when they come. But when he sees them, he thinks of the couple which he has lost, his son and his daughter. And of course, these parts demand, as the parts of Florizel and Perdita demand real beauty of the actor in the actors to be fully successful, which is not always easy to obtain, especially in these days. But when Leontes is quite overcome by the beauty of this young couple, quite objectively, even apart from, they remind him of his loss, but he is not unduly sad, he is serene in his loss and simply marveling at their beauty. And Shakespeare clearly intends that this is the, as it were, as if the earthly paradise rather had entered to him rather than that he should enter the earthly paradise, but it's the same thing. Welcome hither as spring is to the earth, he says to them. And they talk a little, he questions them, but then comes news that the king, his father, is also in Sicilia and is on his way to visit Leontes with Camillo. And that raises more questions, and Florizel has to confess to Leontes the truth, or what he supposes to be the truth, that is, that Perdita is a shepherdess, and the king has forbidden him to see her again, and he begs Leontes to help him to do what he can. And Leontes refuses to commit himself, but he is impressed by the majesty and beauty of this supposed shepherdess, and he clearly is prepared, one feels that he's prepared to help them as much as he can. The audience is, of course, expecting a wonderful scene of recognition, where it is said, where the truth comes out, the shepherd tells everybody that who Perdita is, and the mantle which was found with her is produced as a jewel of her mother's that is there, and there is some jewellery, a ring or something like that of an Antigonus that was taken also by the shepherd's son. And the name Antigonus, of course, is very significant, the husband of Paulina. But we have no such thing. Instead, it is all told us at third hand in a scene of gentlemen who tell how the king embraced Polixenes and how the shepherd came and said that, told the truth about Perdita, and how it was discovered that Perdita was Leontes' lost daughter, and how, of course, the question of all the problems to the marriage of Florizel and Perdita vanished then and there, and what rejoicing there was, and what embracing on all sides, and so on. This we are all told by people who witnessed it without seeing it. And it might seem surprising at first, but there is a very powerful reason for it. Because although the audience know that Perdita is, the shepherdess, is really the daughter of Leontes, there is something they do not know. And it is that Shakespeare is saving up for. And that is why he doesn't have this scene of wonderful joy and mutual recognition directly on the stage. Why he has it just reported to us. Paulina tells that she has a wonderful statue of Hermione, and Perdita expresses a great desire to go at least and see this statue. And they all decide to go to Paulina's house and to see this wonderful statue which has recently been made and which is said to be almost lifelike or entirely lifelike even to the eye. And this statue is in a chapel adjoining Paulina's house. And they all go to this chapel. And what the audience do not know is that Hermione never died, that she remained alive, as she says, in order to see what the oracle said fulfilled, that which is lost was found. She believed that was what the oracle meant. And she has been sharing her husband's spiritual retreat all these years. And now that that which was lost has been found, she feels able to join him again. Paulina leads Leontes to the statue. They all see the statue, and it becomes gradually clearer and clearer that it is not a statue. And finally, to the sound of music, Hermione steps down from the pedestal, and she and Leontes embrace, and she embraces her daughter, and that is the end of the play. But that is the nearest that Shakespeare comes to Dante's Paradiso, the paradise. We've had a clear parallel, an exact parallel to the Inferno in this play, and then the Purgatorio, taken separately, one from the other, as in Dante's epic. But in this play alone, or rather say alone, one could say it's true that the last scene of Cymbeline is so loaded with happiness that one could say this is not earthly, this is paradise, this happiness is that of paradise. It is too great to be earthly. But nonetheless, there is no point at which you could say where this earth becomes paradise. Whereas in this particular play, the last scene in the chapel, I think, is intended by Shakespeare to be the final part of the mysteries. And in any case, the marriage is now complete, and that cannot be limited as a symbol. It can be extended to the very end of the greater mysteries. Now, I don't know what the time is. Oh yes, I have gone on over the hour, but I have finished, really. I think there's nothing more I can say. Right.